Welcome to another Poetica podcast from RN. I'm Justine Sloan-Lees with a feature called Around the Nation 2014. Producer Mike Ladd has been reading through 95 new Australian poetry books sent into Poetica from every corner of the country over the last year or so. In this podcast, Mike presents his selections. There are some old hands included, but in general he's favoured newer poets and their debut collections. Mike also says, "Radio is a sound medium. The poems have to communicate on being heard, not by being studied on the page. This selection is made with that in mind. I avoided the more hermetic and obscure and preferred poems that looked out as well as in, captured a time and a place, embraced a wider politic, gave you something to feel beyond the default melancholy mode, but also something to think about, poems with wit and social comment. The writers hail from Darwin to Launceston, from Sydney through to Perth, and we hope you enjoy this poetic journey around the nation. Our readers are Brant Eustace and Eugenia Fragos."
So many brightly coloured, nicely printed poetry books. Slim volumes, thick tomes, posted from every corner of the land. Hopeful their uncreased spines will be bent back. And still they come, though poetry book publishing, to quote John Knight, is a gloriously uncommercial dream, and he is a poetry publisher. I don't know if there really is a market for all these books. Perhaps some will make a profit, but many will sell only a few hundred copies and won't ever get a second edition. Most wouldn't exist without the subsidies of the Australia Council or the state governments, but some would press on regardless. Poetry in and of itself resists market forces. An outsider in the age of globalisation. Yet almost every poet I've met would like to be better known, and that's my job. So let's begin. In Radar, a new collection he shares with Kevin Brophy, Nathan Curnow writes about his childhood as the son of a preacher in rural South Australia and Victoria. Nathan opens up with a memory of a stage curtain in his father's church hall, and the meaning of that red curtain just keeps expanding.
The curtain. Google Earth, 12 Railway Terrace North, Pinneroo. I gripped the curtain of the empty stage and drew its giant skirt spinning inside until I'd wrung its soft crush of darkness upon my head. Wrapped and waiting for my mother to come. Perhaps I looked like a crimson bell or a strange reminder of my own breech birth with only my feet delivered. There was mystery at the end of the old church hall. Secrets in the wings, in hiding spots for peeking out, in wires set for release. Echoes of glory and accidents, whispers of applause and missed lines. No stained glass light creeping toward me at the speed of the Sunday service. Nameless and native. Far from the chapel stage, beyond the communion rail, baptismal font, flower stands, the steps to my father's pulpit. I belonged to the boards, to the fabric that slipped away from me once again, turning until it spread itself wide, introducing me to the world. Who would be there? What to say? A yearning, I understood, the magic burn of anticipation bound in faith, belief, and trust to convert an audience. To be converted by the strength of a fallible dream. Hoping that what will be revealed is worthy of the curtain opening.
Andy Kassane's new book, Radiance, also digs back into childhood. And in this poem, to one of those time-stopping moments that stay in the mind decades later.
The catch. standing under a rainmaker that is falling towards your waiting hands, it's surprising how much crosses your mind. How you'd like to pash with Kathy McBride behind the grandstand after the game. How the coach said mental toughness was the key to success. How catches win matches. And Doug Walters served in Vietnam because he loved his country. How if your marks don't improve, you won't be allowed to play cricket again for the rest of summer. How the kookaburra hangs in the air like the baggy green you hope to wear. And then, spinning closer, looks like all the mistakes you'll ever make in life. And slips through your cupped fingers in slow motion before rolling to rest right there, at your feet, on the sunburnt grass.
Susan Austin's first full-length collection is called Undertow, and this elegy for her mother has an undertow of anger in the current of love, producing eddies of conflicted emotion.
Tinned pears and dove soap. First, I smashed your handmade ceramic vase. All those pills and still you couldn't win. Then I drove in circles, hurled the flowers out the window. What good was beauty? My hands on the wheel, shaky like your touch. Even from behind Parkinson's rigid screen, you could still ground me. Health, stable mood, presence, all impermanent. But isn't that the lesson? Your mania, an earthquake underneath my life, opened me to the reaches we live between. You lived long enough to teach me the trick of folding nappies for my children, who do not miss you as I do. But with every milestone, the instinct to pick up the phone diminishes. Now clay reminds me of you, and storms, and Mother's Day, and dove soap, and Dad has never looked more tired. Sometimes, facing the tinned pears on the shelves, I freeze while shoppers shove their trolleys round me. Sometimes small personal rain wets my pillowcase. By the morning, it is dry.
Tim Thorne is a political satirist who often plants jokes in his examinations of history and culture. But here on the first page from his latest collection, The Unspeak Poems, he plays it straight. Thumbprints or arrows were put on convict-made bricks as a numbering system. But this one, found in a friend's garden in Tasmania, was different.
Love on a brick. Love, impressed on a convict brick. Instead of an arrow, shows that someone soared out of Van Diemen's Land's cold mud. The word still soars out of its baked clay prison. Which way did it face? Were rats and possums the only witnesses? Or did it bless a family from a warm hearth? Not only as reminder, reproach, or simple wish, but with its heritage of defiance, with its own vector, surer than any bolt. Of all the slogans despair could write, of all the cries for justice or revenge, this was the word chosen. Of all the ways that love could be sent, through air, flesh, paper, to choose clay was a masterstroke. A message baked into a house has lived beyond memory, just as clay was and will be what we are. Love strong enough to stamp bricks can smash chains, file through bars, disarm screws, trick dogs and fly. Through what weather? It has not landed yet. Even in these ruins it has kept hale and pure, its object always clearer than authority, more compelling. We shall build cities with such bricks.
In his book Inadvertent Things, Andrew Lansdowne writes poems in traditional Japanese forms. Some people think there are just too many haiku in this world, but I like them for their concision. And here, the setting is deliberately humble.
Outhouse Haiku. 1. The lavender bush, doing its mauve-scented best beside the outhouse. 2. A spare set of legs next to the daddy long legs on the outhouse door. 3. Tonight, I forgive the farmhouse its faults. Such stars above the outhouse. 4. Inside the outhouse at midnight. What was that noise outside the outhouse?
Diane Fay's collection, The Stone Garden, also uses a Japanese form, but this time the tanka, with its pattern of 5-7-5-7-7 syllable lines. She grafts this form onto rural Ireland. The Stone Garden is a record of a visit to Clare and the Rocky Burren region. The little poems often seem no more than travel diary notes, passing impressions of landscapes and people. This one digs deeper, though, and reverses a 9th-century Irish poem which says, "Three times when speech is better than silence, when urging a king to battle, when reciting a well-turned line of poetry, when giving due praise."
At a famine graveyard. Three times when silence is better than speech. Holding new life. Letting sea waves slice through you. Beholding a slope sown with the hunger's dead.
But I'd question that last line. Silence as a first reaction, perhaps, as a mark of respect. But shouldn't we also keep talking about the history so we don't forget? Anyway, there's an irony here. By writing a poem about silence, Diane Fay breaks it. Birth, love, death. These are the topics poetry so often deals with on its small, grand scale. In fact, these are the times in life, sometimes the only ones, when the general public think about reaching for a poem. Tony Lintermans writes poetry in a clear, direct style with carefully managed sound patterns. From his new book, Weather Walks In, this one covers both the love and birth themes.
Welcome. Blind, mute, astounded, you slide headlong into hands from your cramped harbour, slippery with vernix and blood. We watch the midwife check you over. I cut the cord. Your first cry dismisses every alibi. Hollering's useless, little one. What seas heaved, the sun will surely dry. Though your shipwreck's just begun, we castaways lack company. Asleep now, your old man frown frets above the eiderdown. The midwife leaves at dawn for home. Querulous, nearly weightless in my arms, I stroke you in the shadowed room like worry beads, counting calm. Your mother's hair, father's nose, a traveller's sheen in your eyes. Before the putting on begins, of hungers, irritations at night, the world's disheartening pigeons, a fact, love's not erudite or fixed, but a vagrant sea, which, bringing you, swamped me.
Lucy Williams published her first book back in 2000, so this new one called Internal Weather has been 14 years in the making. She's been making a family as well, and like Tony Lintermans, her poetry deals with those fundamentals of the life cycle.
Baby. All day I think about babies, the possibility of them lying in wait like new love. We have decided to try, and now, between us, the idea rests as if on some holiday horizon. It's there, but we can't touch it yet. The textbooks say at 35 my eggs are running out. I think of my four sisters, my brother who died at 37, how all of us are linked by blood, by memory and hope, and know that my body can do anything. My five-year-old daughter aches for a baby in the house. Her unfledged love is better than mine, devoid of worry or questions. It dapples the walls like light through a suncatcher and charms me into faith. All day I bump around the house, intoxicated by babies. I want to give you this. Place your hand on my stomach for you to feel the first testing flutter, then the languid roll of limbs. Want to remember the look on your face. Carry it with me into a reliable future. Miscarriage. We lost you, tiny immigrant, as you negotiated with the gods of chance or nature to stay. I read about your arrival as though you were a prophet. I read until I knew too well all the things that could go wrong. Sometimes I would think of you ready to be born, your father struck dumb by the sudden weight of love as you leave my body and find him waiting. I'm sorry I don't get to meet you, that history keeps you unfinished, under wraps. I'm sorry you will never learn about the human heart, unbuttoned like a giant pocket, and all the things that spill every time we trip, and all the things that stay.
But that's not the end of the story. The book goes on to tell of the arrival of other children, the challenges of raising them, and to explore Lucy's own family background. She uses the word heart a lot in this collection, which is risky, but it's good to read poetry that isn't afraid of the word and that does have heart. I couldn't make much of Canberra poet Paul McGee's first collection, called, obscurely enough, Cube Root of Book, but I like his new one, Stone Postcard, a lot more. It contains a plain-spoken but moving elegy to his father, some fresh translations of Virgil — McGee studied classical languages — and some gutsy slice-of-life realism. Here he combines that political edge with his preference for playing with language.
A farm gate. He is still here, the Watergate man, who opened the floodgates. Lots of travel gates, Contra Gate, Billy Gate, Gupta Gate, some pizza gate or other, Gargle Gate, Squidgy Gate, Zipper Gate, Wine Gate, Royal Lying in State Gate, Dick Cheney shot a guy in the face gate, Nipple Gate, Here is your sweet pardon gate. When democracy is calling liars to account and you've no other power than making them pay for it at the next box office, you're a real theatre critic. The poor gilded clowns speak through their harps. I am Nero, who of course was hated for acting, and might be in power still were he not for that deposed. His actual mistake was to kill a general. The other generals didn't like it. Or him. Our own new big man, without sleeping, has been dipping into the media cycle, words for the media to sniff and inspect, and eye coldly and chew. Then he gets up and lip-syncs for the companies, which are organised as great dictatorships, whose generals put the business case on the actors' table. A business case, of course. Sheer beauty inside it. A gentle breeze of non-competition of powers, monopoly, duopoly, quadropoly, and massive efficiency gains in the grateful dairy farms.
Speaking of farms, Benjamin Dodds grew up in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, not far from Yanco in New South Wales. I'm impressed by the visual acuity and muscular language of his debut collection, Regulator. Now, a regulator, I think, is basically a weir, so when you lift the gates, the calm silence on one side is countered by chaos and watery noise on the other.
Galvanised gates lift to divide the calm from the chaotic. Input, process, output. On this narrow bridge, the world is out of whack. It's like listening to a stereo with the sound wound up and the balance knob turned fully left or right. On the bank, a fading slump of a sign shows a black stick figure in the throes of the Australian crawl, overlaid with a thick circle, bisected by an equally thick diagonal line. Metres from here, dangerously adolescent men in wet, sucking board shorts queue at the bridge to drop again into the irrigation canal. The sleeping surface snares their bombs and pin drops from the baking sky and drags them down where it's gut-punch cold. Chased by churning echoes, they become a function of the violent process of current. To funnel through its breathless grip takes maybe 10 seconds, long enough to induce a personal panic, which must be neatly filed away before the final re-emergence into tingling spume and the muted whoops of brotherhood back at the regulator, shockingly far upstream. On Monday's school bus, they lift thin senior shirts over awkward shoulders to compare backs broad and brown as hen's eggs, lacerated by steel from neck to crack.
Another debut collection this year is by Todd Turner, and it's called Woodsmoke. Todd is a jeweller by trade, and it's tempting to say that that shows in his highly crafted verse, so I will. This one is about the very thing we're listening to right now, though a pretty ancient model. I like the end of the poem too, where he refers to an early Van Gogh painting of peasants gathered around a lamp as they eat a meal of potatoes in their dark, grimy house.
Murmured in sepia tones, first creak of the morning, routine cock crow, muffled sermon of kettle and cup. Little lamplight, dear hub of the house, dawn kindler of draughts and crackled leaves, sweet shepherd of hob-fired broth, spirit level of whim and woe. Your console hummed from the rungs of the kitchen, where no stool nor step could reach your touch-tuned hearth. Upon the table, a stove-warmed stout jug bubbled and brewed. Knee-worn chair legs slid in under shadowed nooks. We sat and listened, hunched in the quiet. Potato eaters in the communal dark.
Steve Brock is a South Australian poet with a deceptively light touch. He writes with the rambling humour of Ken Bolton, combined with some of the plain-speaking punchiness of Jeff Goodfellow. A weird combination of influences, I admit, but somehow it works. Here's the title poem from his newly published second book.
Double glaze. Sometimes it's like a low tide, and the objects on my desk are left stranded around me as I gaze out the office window, looking for something outside of me to fill the emptiness. It might begin the next morning with a small exchange in the coffee shop, where we create shared meaning around an experience, even if it was only reality TV. And soon, There's a density to things. And the collective flow slowly lifts until I find myself in a pub laughing over after-work drinks. While above us, in a window in the corner of the room, I see them crashing against the edge of this, desperate to get in. But we can't hear them above the background noise. I see their children drowning. But don't mention this as we wave goodbye and take our separate journeys home.
That image, the Christmas Island disaster, seen out of the corner of the eye on the pub television, also haunts Sandra Thibodeau in her latest book, Dirty H2O.
Julia Gillard observes Christmas. In the arbitrary swirls of Australia's waters, we keep an island for Christmas, where cliffs pop champagne bones again and again and hurl Mary's boy child towards someone else's zone, where a star misleads a boat to the wrong side of the season and a mother suddenly knows love won't be enough. Just let me say, jumping in with you could have been my death.
Sandra lives and writes in the NT, and this next poem focuses on an actual case of an Aboriginal boy's death at Borroloola. The coroner handed down a damning report and found that the death was not properly investigated by police.
Just so. Not the pockets, the coroner repeats. The shorts. Rocks in his shorts, between his legs. Biggest plates spilling as the boy is lifted from the waterhole. Rocks drop like crockery on the inquest. Red singlet pressed to his nana's chest, the scent of her washing powder. Coroner's shots. 1. Tracks lead from safe place to burial site. 2. Callous toes press mud. 3. Shadows finger the hardened prints. 4. Now on their way to another little boy. Careful selection. A red singlet and navy shorts for the Shanghai shooter who's happiest on a horse who keeps a red heeler close. Except that day. Point 80. An irrational focus on accidental drowning swims into view. No child would want to dive into that shallow grave. Destroyed swabs, drained eyes, cops who need the dead to stay down and out of the headlines. Years pass before the singlet makes it home. Clothes just so. Red piping on the shorts, navy stripe across the singlet, a shark logo. They were coming into town for the old man's funeral. One tipped into earth while another is held beneath water, rocks weighing his shorts, taking his breath. Days later, his bare brown chest lifts and stirs an irrational focus, a bad call. Clumsy steps. Nearby, a number 8 shirt, 4X can, DNA of a sex offender, inexplicable loss of things. Just so. Conclusion? Delays and dirtied evidence led nowhere, like prints that arrived or left or scuffled to survive. No. They fell as children will, in the hands of police with other things planned for the weekend.
From the other end of the country, Sarah Day's new book, her 7th, is called Tempo. And as you might guess from that title, its focus is on time and change. In this poem, her hometown of Hobart is seen as a palimpsest, a portrait where the underpaintings of history show through the new surfaces.
Port. At Hobart's port, the pasts, tucked away behind a tight veneer of gallery, tappy, New Zealand possum and export grand merino. Blue sky bounces off the gloss white at the marina. Fishing boats squeeze into Constitution Dock. Queen Victoria's renegade untouchables. But there are rumours of new developments at the freight wharves. Fewer ships, the last train, luxury accommodation in the working warehouse. Ghosts of canned jam and tomato ride the conveyor belts through five-star hotel and boutique Aboriginal art. At dawn, fishing trawlers tout their catch. No rusting Japanese tubs alongside now. Shark fins pegged along rigging like ghastly washing lines. Antarctic working ships zigzag across the glassy wake of luxury liners. Fairy lights are tinsel in the lime trees all year round. The shadow of gasworks lies under a construction site. Grain silos entombed in Riverview apartments. Old Wapping's broken crockery and iron forks scratch beneath the Symphony Orchestra and International Hotel. An isthmus of clean sand and pebble lies incognito under the jam factory, which is inside the School of Art. The mouth of the rivulet is a dry memory of a time when it knew how to chart its own course. History has been sandblasted cleaner than a freestone quarry. Everything rearranges. The cemetery that was underneath the park, the deep bush inside the graves, the great blue gums that grew to the clear waters of the river's broad plain. Industrial cranes, the overseers, beckon sublimely to the future perfect.
Quirky is the word I'd be tempted to use about Paul Mitchell's poetry. But that word, like iconic and passionate, has just about been flogged to death. So what's another word for quirky? Not your standard issue anyway. This one is from his collection, Standard Variation.
How to stop writing. While I study a book on deconstruction, my next-door neighbour constructs a garage, hammer blow by hammer blow. I can't see my neighbour through my study walls, but I can picture what he's tap-tap doing, tap. While I write a poem about studying a book on deconstruction, I imagine my neighbour's arms constructing a garage while thinking, while I put up a garage where my old garage used to be, my next-door neighbour's in his study. I wonder what he's studying. I know he studies writing. I wonder if he's studying writing now. While I write a poem about my neighbour's imagination while studying a book on deconstruction, interrupted by the sound of construction, I notice my first line. While I study. So I stop writing.
Benedict Andrews is well known as a theatre director. He's just published his first book of poems, penned, it seems, between rehearsals, in transit, and while living out of a suitcase. Such is the fate of international theatre practitioners.
Jit. The woman, leaning out of the apartment window, shut her eyes and pressed her face toward the sun which glinted in the glass of her neighbour's top-story window. has splintered into rainbows along graffiti tags scratched across the window of the S-Bahn carriage, where I was travelling back to the rehearsal room for the evening session, following lunch, and a siesta at home. When she shut her eyes, the speeding train froze, and the blackbirds hung like buckshot holes in the whitewashed sky. A pinged ping-pong ball hovered between two kids at a table in the park. The drug dealers in the bushes, golden fist, packing in fingers, suspended their hushy trade. A girl's tongue stopped feeling wiggly in the midst of her very first kiss. And for a while, the jet did not trail. The word was unsaid. The knife didn't cut. The wheel didn't turn. The heart didn't beat. The breeze did not blow and the door did not shut. All screens crashed. Here was one buried. Here was one coming back. Here was a machine for disappearing. A machine for ruin. And a machine of tiny accidents. While we were stopped in our tracks, sticky rubber plants grew behind lace-curtained windows, grew sticky, green and ganglionated around the apartment block inhabitants' stricken limbs and down their dumbstruck mouths. She opens her eyes into a blinding sun. The observable world jitters, set again in motion.
And finally, back to the West in this 2014 Poetica survey of new Australian poetry. Anna Maria Weldon has spent 5 years documenting the Yalgarup National Park, which includes Lake Clifton and its extraordinary living rocks, the Thrombolites. The resulting book of essays, photographs and poems is called The Lake's Apprentice.
Birthbed. At sundown, we reach the lake. Its surface ablaze out west, the near shore in shadow where a salt marsh loomed. Calm old midwife waiting for full moon to rise. Under the water, thrombolites were disks of light, acres of cratered stone shaped like cocoons. Memories the wintering lake held deep in amniotic sleep. Then, like a birthing head, the lunar circle crowned between the trees, and lakebed rocks glowed luminous as blooms under black glass. When she was waterborne, floating in their midst, they came close around her bed to claim a sister the sky won't release. But Earth cannot forget.
And in this Poetica podcast from RN, we've been listening to Around the Nation 2014. Selections from new Australian poetry publications. Our readers were Eugenia Fragos and Brant Eustace. The sound engineers were Gabriel Agostino and Tom Henry, and the program was produced by Mike Ladd. And if you're interested to follow up on any of the writing you've just heard, go to the Poetica webpage, where you'll find a full list of titles and those brave independent poetry publishers who've produced the books. You can also start a conversation by leaving us a comment. We're interested in your thoughts on what you've heard, positive or negative. As long as they're respectful and thoughtful, we'll post them on our site. In our next podcast, we continue our September focus on contemporary Australian writing with Tasmanian poet Catherine Lomer and her new collection, Night Writing.